Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Renowned futurist and New York Times bestselling author Peter Diamandis joins us by telephone. He's on the road in Vancouver, Canada, where he just recorded his TED Talk for the 2014 series. We'll find out why he says today's philanthropists and entrepreneurs are more empowered than ever to solve humanity's greatest challenges. Dr. Peter Diamandis, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here.
You are a scientist, an engineer, and a medical doctor with degrees from MIT and Harvard Medical School. How did you become a futurist?
I guess mostly because I wanted to make the future that I was seeing happen. And, one of my mottos is the best way to predict the future is create it yourself. And my life has been dedicated to creating the future that I think is important in a range of different fields.
You say in your book, Abundance, that because of technology, we have the potential to improve the lives of every man, woman, and child on the planet. Explain.
I do, and it is. It's just the book came out 2 years ago. Bill Gates last week put out a blog and put out a series of articles pretty much stating the same thing. Easier for him with some $70 billion under his, under his coat. But if you look at what's happened over the last 100 years, the human lifespan has more than doubled. The per capita income for every nation on this planet has more than tripled. The cost of food has dropped 13-fold, energy 20-fold, transportation 100-fold, communications 1,000-fold. We're living during the most peaceful time ever in human history. And the fact is those things, all very measurable, all very real, didn't happen because we got smarter or because we have better politicians. Those things have happened as a result of technology. Technology has really transformed that which used to be scarce into something that's now abundant. And it's changing our world, though many of us, frankly, are immune or numb to that change. You know, we're constantly deluged by the negative media 24/7 from every device you have that colors our world, but that's not the case. It's the world is getting better on almost every measurable front.
That optimistic outlook is hard for some people to reconcile, especially when they consider that as recently as 1970, our world population was 3.6 billion people. It's now 7.2 billion and climbing.
Yeah, and the fact is that there are two things that consistently reduce a population growth rate. I don't know if you know what those two things are by any chance.
Education is one of them.
Education is one and health care is the other. And we're really heading towards a world of abundant health and education where the cost of getting the world's best education and the world's best health care is effectively heading towards zero. It's going to disrupt both industries massively this decade. And people go, what are you, crazy? How can you be saying that? Well, it's happening as a result of the technology we carry on in our pocket, AI, robotics, a series of things. You know, the notion that in Africa, a Maasai warrior on a cell phone or on a smartphone on Google has better mobile comm and access to more knowledge than President Clinton had just, 15, 20 years ago. But that's the case. Google and wireless telephony has democratized, it's leveled access to information. And that same technology will level access to the best education and the best health care. So we're going to start to see the world's population probably peak in the 9 to 9.5 billion and then start to drop. And at the same time, as the world's population is going up, more and more of us are being connected. We're going from 2 billion to 5 billion people connected on the planet. And that connection is driving a massively increased rate of innovation, which helps us solve more and more problems.
Speaking of education, you point out in your book that our current education system was created 150 years ago around the ideas of standardization and conformity. What are the necessary skills for the 21st century, and what impact does that focus on standardization and on rote memory have on creativity, on innovation?
Yeah, good point. I mean, it's sad how our education system is today across the board. It really is built on the Industrial Revolution model. It's the assembly line for students. The students are in a classroom, the bell rings, and they move out and move into the next classroom. It's cogs and widgets. And we are focused on rote memorization, which, of course, is ridiculous in the day of smartphones and Google. today, I think what's really critically needed is imagination, is curiosity. I have 2 3-year-old boys at home, and I think about what I'm going to teach them. But, you know, in most schools, when you go and you do something outside of the norm, when you color outside the lines, you know, your hand is slapped, you know, go color back inside the lines, when that's exactly the opposite of what we need today. We don't need people who are going to conform and color inside the lines. We need people who are going to explore and be curious and be passionate about whatever it is.
1/3 of U.S. public school students fail to graduate from high school, and most drop out because they say they are bored and because it seems irrelevant. You say what we need to do is make education wildly entertaining and addictive. How do we do that?
School is boring. The fact of the matter is, it is irrelevant. You know, I spent a decade at MIT and Harvard learning a bunch of things, and you know, the fact of the matter is, you don't use those things ever again. I mean, when's the last time you go to a job and your employer says, can you write me a thesis on this subject? And it just isn't valid anymore. We need to make school and learning relevant to our current world. And it's really about helping the student figure out what they're really truly passionate about and driving creativity in those regards. The gaming industry today, whatever your favorite game platform is, does an amazing job. You know, we sort of talk about how terrible it is that students spend 4, 5, 6 hours a day addicted to their games. Well, there's a lesson there. You know, make it fun, make it exciting, make it curiosity-based, make it something. You know, here's the example. When you start at school, you start with a grade average of an A, and every time you do something wrong, your grade average goes down. Very demotivating. When you start in the gaming world, you start with 0, and every time you do something right, you gain points moving upwards. It's a complete flip. We can use the whole thesis for gaming and how it works to really get people excited about learning, where they learn not because I'm 10 years old, I'm in fifth grade. It's, you know, whatever age you are, you know, be in a group of peers who care about the same things, mixed age, mixed everything. And I think that will drive a revolution in how we learn. And that's something which I think is very possible today. We're going to have the best artificial intelligence agents, the best AI agents teaching a billionaire's child in Manhattan at the same time that that same artificial intelligence is teaching the poorest of the poor in Mumbai.
So you suggest that we need to change the way we measure a student's progress, and what we're teaching them isn't what they'll need in the 21st century, and what we're teaching them isn't sticking anyway. So what do we do?
Again, I think about this from the perspective of my own family, and I get this asked a lot of times when I'm doing keynotes around the world, and I tell them, you know, for me, the most important thing I want to convey to my kids are to help them find out what they're passionate about. If they're passionate about, you know, collecting dolls or about, you know, video games, it doesn't really matter. They need to be passionate about something, because that passion is going to drive them in a world where anything is possible. The other thing is curiosity, you know, where you have a passion and you follow that passion. We're going to be entering a world where, like Tony Stark in Iron Man, we're going to be surrounded by robotics and AI, and we're going to be driven by the questions we ask and searching for answers. Our occupation in the future may not be jobs. It may be how we occupy our time, how we contribute to society, how we go and investigate the things we want to investigate. We may be, you know, maybe diving into investigating virtual worlds, for all I know. But the world ahead of us is going to be changing at a more and faster pace. And the structures of society we have today are not going to survive that rate of change.
Your passion since the age of 8 has been space exploration, and you've helped to develop that field by incentivizing it through the Ansari X Prize. You got the idea by reading a book, The Spirit of St. Louis, about Charles Lindbergh. Tell us a little bit about that story.
Sure. I was born in the 60s, sort of came into awareness, if you would, during the Apollo moon landings and Star Trek, and I bought that hook, line, and sinker, right? I was so passionate about space. It was where I was going to go. You know, I drank all the Tang I can get my hands on. It was driving me. My parents, both immigrants from Greece, wanted me to be a doctor, follow my dad's footsteps, and I ended up, harboring that secret passion of space, but outwardly, you know, going pre-med and ending up at Harvard Med School, all to make my mom and dad happy. But all along, my true joy was, how do I open up space? How do I get to go there myself? And along the way, I learned that my chances of becoming a NASA astronaut were 1 in 1,000 at best. And I decided to do it privately. I decided that what I wanted to do was try and open the space frontier so I could go outside the government system. Long story short, I've started about 17 companies to date, about 10 or 11 of them in the space world. You know, Zero G, that we do weightless parabolic flights. We flew Stephen Hawking into Zero G. Another company called Space Adventures that sends people to the space station. We've sent 8 clients up there. Our 9th client is the pop opera singer Sarah Brightman, is going up in about 15 months. And another company called Planetary Resources that is backed by a group of a dozen billionaires to go and identify, prospect, and ultimately mine near-Earth approaching asteroids for, you know, strategic metals and fuels. And it's an amazing world we live in where we can even have that conversation on the phone today, you know, where we can talk about mining asteroids. And it's because we're unlocking these exponential technologies that's making that happen.
You say it's not only these exponential technologies, but also 3 additional forces that are at play right now. One is this do-it-yourself revolution. The other is this new breed of what you call techno-philanthropists. Bill Gates or Mark Zuckerberg. And then this third is, we talked a little bit about it earlier, the rising billion, the poorest of the poor, who are now connected and want their piece of the pie.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you think about the notion that in the past, those people who had access to local resources were able to survive and thrive, the number of people who are gaining more and more access to resources is growing exponentially, and the resource that they have access to is the web, the wireless world. We're going from 2 billion people connected on the Internet in 2010 to 5 billion people connected in 2020. Over the next, 6 years, we're going to have about 3 billion new minds enter the global conversation, and those individuals connected on the web through a smartphone, through a tablet, through whatever means, now have access to the world's information. They will soon have access to artificial intelligence, 3D printing, robotics, synthetic biology. All of these technologies, which have been in deceptive growth, are becoming disruptive and are effectively becoming demonetized, are becoming available for free and democratized, available to everybody. And it's a new breed of what I call techno-philanthropists, people who have made extraordinary wealth in their life in the technology world, who are helping drive that. It's folks like a Bill Gates, like a Larry Page, like a Richard Branson, like others, whose technologies are really trying to serve everybody. And, you know, it starts where the wealthiest have access to a car or a plane or a cell phone, and where eventually, because they paid the high, ridiculous prices up front, eventually they become cheaper and available to everybody. So that's the world we're heading into. You know, The Economist published a cover article in June of this year in which they showed how we are literally taking billions of people out of extreme poverty. And if you project that forward, we're really heading towards a world where people will have all of their basic needs met: water, food, housing, energy, healthcare, learning. You know, it's not about creating a world of luxury. Not all, 9 billion people are going to have a luxurious world, but those individuals are going to have their basic needs met. And when you have your basic needs met, you can turn your time, instead of walking for 2 days to find healthcare, or instead of spending 6 hours to find firewood to boil water, you can now turn your time to educating your kids, to becoming productive. That's going to be transformational. It's not 30 years from now, it's this decade.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is Dr. Peter Diamandis. He's the chairman and co-founder of Singularity University, which teaches graduate students as well as the world's top executives how to apply exponential technologies to address humanity's biggest challenges. So what makes him so optimistic about the future? We're talking about that with him. You acknowledge that there will be bumps in the road, and you write in your book that we are hardwired to focus on the negative. The amygdala is the danger detector in our brains. And I'm wondering, is there anything, perhaps even pessimism, that could derail this abundant future that you foresee?
On our road to abundance, there will be turbulence. When I talk about the last 100 years being an extraordinary century of progress and growth, driven by technology, and that technology is increasing in its rate. Even though that happened over the last century, and you ask anybody, the last 100 years, was there an improvement in human standards of living? They would say yes. We still had World War I, World War II, the Spanish flu, Vietnam War, 150 million people perished. And as we continue towards this world of abundance, will there be terrorism? Will there be cyber attacks? Will there be all these things? Yes, of course. I'm not, talking about a techno-utopian world. I'm talking about a world in which these things happen. Technology reduces the rate of violence. We've seen that from Steven Pinker's book at Harvard, Better Angels of Our Nature. I think one of the things that really concerns me is that a lot of us, our visions of the world is shaped by the news media. And the news media focuses 90% of the news time on negative news. If it bleeds, it leads. And there's a reason for that. At the end of the day, our brains evolved on the savannas of Africa millions of years ago. And if you missed a piece of good news back then, well, that's too bad. But if you missed a piece of bad news, like the rustle in the wheat leaves where it's a tiger and not the wind, your genes were out of the gene pool. So all of us have evolved a piece of the ancient temporal lobe called an amygdala, which scans everything we see and everything we hear for negative news. And if we see negative news, we're put on red alert. And for that reason, we pay far more attention to negative news than positive news, which is why 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, we are bombarded on our cell phones, our tablets, our radio, our newspaper on negative news. It's a drug, and the news media, unfortunately, has become a drug pusher in that regard.
Could that derail this optimistic future you envision?
So it could, in extreme. No question, if there was an asteroid hits the Earth or a massive nuclear war occurs. But the probability of these things happening actually decreases with technology because it becomes harder and harder to do things in secret. We now are living in a world where every transaction is digital, where it's all traceable, where it's hard for a terrorist to hide things. It used to be that a lot of the most heinous crimes took place when people in the dark, or people didn't know. But there is now light being shown every place, the mobile networks, the space satellite observation systems. It's hard to do anything and do it in secret these days. And I think that radical transparency is going to help us keep the world more peaceful than ever before.
You've already mentioned that two critical motivators are fear and curiosity, but a third one is greed. How concerned are you about these same exponential technologies in the hands of someone with nefarious aims?
So, I write about this in Abundance where I say there are four basic motivators: fear, curiosity, and greed. And the fourth is a search for human significance. Fear got us to the moon. It was a reaction to Sputnik and the first cosmonaut, Gagarin. Curiosity is a weak motivator. And you can actually measure the difference between fear and curiosity as a motivator. It's the ratio of the defense budget to the science budget, at least in the United States. Greed is, or wealth creation, to give it a more positive term, is one of the most important drivers. It's driven everything that we have that we take for granted: ubiquitous cell phone networks, Google, GPS, all of the technologies that we have. We're driven by companies wanting to make a profit and, in a result, increasing our quality of life orders of magnitude. People say, aren't we widening the gap between the rich and the poor going forward? And the way I would think about it is we're going from a world of have and have-nots to a world where everyone is a have. Everybody has their basic needs met, but we have super haves as well. Will we have people who are extremely wealthy, able to, live indefinite lifetimes or go travel to the stars? Yes. But would I rather have a world where it was 100 years ago or even 20 years ago, where in a good part of the world, a lot of families don't name their children till they're 5 years old because the chance of their child dying is a third, where it's a 30% infant mortality rate? No, I'd rather have a world where everybody has their health care, their literacy, their water, their food, and they have the potential to strive for an amazing world ahead.
I mentioned that you are probably best known for creating the Ansari X Prize to incentivize commercial spaceflight. And you did that by working with an insurance company who bet against your ability of finding a winner for that program. And of course you did, and they paid out. But I wonder, can everything be incentivized?
You know, I think about this in saying that, not all problems can be solved with incentive prizes, and not all incentive prizes are X prizes. We launch two or three big X prizes a year. We're getting ready to launch one of our biggest, which is a global literacy X prize to teach 100 million kids around the world how to read, write, and code without any schools, any teachers. It's about an AI platform that can gamify, make it compelling, make it fun, knows the child's passion, interest, favorite color, sports star, and knows what they did that day, and really gives them a compelling education where there is nothing, right? People have asked, can you fix the government with incentive prizes? And I think the answer is no there. Incentive prizes are for teams that are small teams of graduate students, university students, who take a look at a problem and really look at it in a brand new way. I like to say that the day before something is truly a breakthrough, it's a crazy idea. And if it wasn't a crazy idea the day before, it wouldn't be a breakthrough. It would be an incremental improvement. And a lot of times the experts in our world are the people who tell us exactly how something can't be done. They're so stuck in the way they think, and it really takes a novice, someone who came from completely outside the field, to say, well, why can't you do it this way? And most of them will fail. But when a novice really tries a brand new approach and pulls it off, then you've got a breakthrough and we all win.
Well, speaking of prizes and space exploration, Penn State's Lunar Lion team is the only university-led team pursuing the Google Lunar X Prize. The team is attempting to land a robotic spacecraft on the moon to become the first non-governmental organization and the first university to explore the moon. Based on your experience, what advice do you have for this team?
So I'm thrilled for them, and I love the fact that they've not only done well, but done extremely well. And they're one of the teams really in the finals of the $30 million Google Lunar X Prize. Their challenge is going to be less technology and more fundraising. So my message is to all the university alums out there, wouldn't you love to put your university flag on the moon? And why aren't you funding this team, and why aren't you supporting them with your sponsorship, your donations, and everything you have? Because that's what it's going to take. It's going to really, getting to the moon now is possible. It can be done by private companies, private university teams. You know, it's a matter of actually having the visionary financial capital to back this audacious thing to happen. But when it does happen, it's one for the history books. Believe me, when I was raising my money for the Ansari X Prize for private spaceflight, it took me 5 years to raise the $10 million, and everybody told me it can't be done, it's ridiculous. You know, everybody from Richard Branson to Fred Smith at FedEx turned me down, and, 150 pitches later, it was the Ansari family who put up the money, and I had many, many phone calls saying, man, oh man, I wish we had backed you. What extraordinary success.
That brings me to failure, which you mentioned and is, in fact, one of your laws, Peter's laws. It's number 25, and it goes like this: fail early, fail often, fail forward. I'd like your thoughts on taking risks.
In a world where you don't take risk, you can't have breakthroughs. So, NASA's famous saying, well, failure is not an option. Well, if failure is not an option, then either is breakthroughs, either is success. If you're focused on your product being absolutely perfect, by the time you launch it, you'll have spent a ton of money and time, and you have no idea whether the product actually is going to be wanted by the consumers. And so the way it's done in Silicon Valley, and it really is a methodology used over and over again, is to really get your first product out there as soon as possible, let it fail, get feedback, and then iterate, iterate, iterate. You know, the founder of LinkedIn has a famous saying of, if you're not embarrassed by the first release of your product, you've launched it too late. And it's the way that a lot of folks like Lockheed Skunk Works, like Google X, which is Google's Skunk Works, operate. You've got to rapidly iterate and rapidly try new things. You know, Jeff Bezos talks about this at Amazon, that if you're going to succeed, you need to fail frequently. You need to have really thick skin and not care what the public says. And it's hard because we live in a society that failure can be scarring. But thank God in the U.S., at least in parts of Silicon Valley, you know, if you haven't failed, you're looked at strangely. If you failed, you've learned. But other parts of the world where there is a structured caste system in India or England, you know, fail once and you're doomed, and they don't have the innovative rates of creation that we have here.
I mentioned earlier Singularity University, which you founded, and some 80 graduate students work with you each year learning about these transformative technologies and then putting them to work to create a company that can have an impact on a billion people. To date, what's the most exciting company or invention that has come from that?
Yeah, the university is up in Silicon Valley. It's backed by Google and Autodesk, Cisco and Genentech, and we're the university focused on teaching grad students and executives about all the rapidly growing exponential technology. So it's not certified. It's not traditional in any fashion. And every summer, we gather 80 graduate students from 3,000 applicants around the world, and they go through a 10-week program, 5 weeks focused on AI, robotics, synthetic biology, digital printing, 3D, digital medicine, computers, networks, and such. And then they have to start a company at the end of the program that has the potential to impact a billion people within a decade in a positive fashion. And I like to remind people, that's the world we're living in today. You can start a company as an entrepreneur that can positively impact the lives of a billion people. You know, it used to have to be Coca-Cola with arms and legs in 200 countries to do that. You don't anymore. And we've started a multitude of companies. One company is basically mining metals out of e-waste. It realized that, you know, most of our electronic waste in the United States is shipped to a province in China where kids and adults pick the circuit boards for different metals, and it causes a huge birth defect rate in that country. And instead of shipping it there, this company has realized they can grind it up into a slurry, extract the copper and silver and gold out of those metals using synthetic biology and other techniques much better than taking those materials out of current mines. Another company called Matternet realized that to build the roads in Africa that we have equivalent in the United States would cost $1 trillion+. It will never happen. So why not skip the roads in Africa the same way that communication skipped wired, communications went to wireless? And they came up with the idea of Matternet about 4 years ago. And Matternet is the idea of using autonomous drones to carry, you know, 5-kilogram packages from village to village, medical supplies, spare parts, whatever it might be, rather than having to build the roads. And it turns out to be cheaper than using couriers on bicycles. It's amazing.
I can see that you're starting to lose your voice. I know you've been talking for days. You've been involved in TED Talks. So thank you so much, Dr. Peter Diamandis, for talking with us today.
My pleasure. Looking forward to sharing this with all the students and everybody in the community.
That was Dr. Peter Diamandis, a commercial space pioneer, inventor, and co-author of the best-selling book, Abundance, The Future is Better Than You Think. He runs the XPRIZE Foundation, which offers large cash incentive prizes to inventors who can solve grand challenges such as spaceflight, low-cost mobile medical diagnostics, and oil spill cleanup, among other things. To learn more, check the links at our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.